Hi, everybody. My name is Joan O'Neill, and I'm a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. I don't know why I'm nervous this time, but I am. So it's okay. I asked God to do it for me, so he's going to do it for me. I need some hugs. Would you turn to the person on either side of you and give them a hug and just send it up to me? Thank you. That's neat. Thank you very much. I read in one of our books that recovery means getting something back, and I got back me. Through alcoholism, I lost me, and somewhere along the way, and somehow I got myself back through the Al-Anon program. I love alcoholics, I'll say that first. It'll be pretty obvious when you hear my story. male or female, I really do. I prefer them sober. I was born in a little town in New York, Mount Kisco, New York, and that is right next to Bedford Hills, New York. And we all know Bedford Hills, New York is the home, or was the home, of Bill and Lois Wilson, people who are near and dear to our hearts. I wasn't involved in Al-Anon until I moved to the Toledo, Ohio area. But in looking back, I can remember going to meetings in Bedford Hills, New York, because my father-in-law was a member of AA for many, many years. And he and my husband did Lois and Bill's gardening. As you know, Lois loved to garden. So she was very close to Steve Schutte and my ex-husband, Ed Schutte. And I have pictures of our first grandson sitting on Lois's lap in her living room, and it's very precious to us. Anyway, I was born many, many years ago. And I was the third child. I have an older sister and an older brother, and right from the start I was nicknamed Baby, and for many, many years that was a very appropriate nickname, because I was very immature, very spoiled. I wanted what I wanted right away, whenever I could get it, right away preferably. And my mother raised us. My father was busy doing his own thing with the opposite sex. He loved baseball, and he loved women. And so he would come back, leave us, come back, leave us, come back, leave us, come back. I was just telling George recently, when I was a little girl, we never had too many toys, but my aunt had given us some baby dolls and a Shirley Temple doll, and I was only a little thing. And I guess I got great pleasure out of dropping them out of the second story window and watching them break. I don't know why. I'm not really that kind of person, but whenever my mother would tell me, I'd say, I can't believe I did that. She'd say, oh, yeah, and you'd laugh, you know. Oh, dear. Also, I feel that I was destined for this program from a very young age. When I was about 2 years old and just recuperating from chickenpox, my father came home and said, Mary, hurry up and get Baby ready. There's a beauty contest in town. I want to enter her. So she put on a plain little dress and on me, and I had my little animals and went to the beauty pageant or whatever it was for little kids. And there was one for the healthiest. I didn't win that because I was a nice little thin thing then. And then one for the best dressed, and then one for the prettiest, and I won the one for the prettiest. And one of the reasons the judges picked me they said, was because of how I went around to all the little children, little girls, and I would, the ones that were crying, I would hug them, and I would give them my little toys to play with, and I would try to fix them. And I do believe that that was, I think, I really think that was born in me. I really think that was there. And I still do it within reason today. It's, I still, that's my first reaction. I gotta fix it, you know. And then, anyway, we had a pretty normal childhood, I think. My mother made sure of that. She worked hard to support us, and because my dad didn't have anything much to do with that. He was more a father in name only, and he would just take us to show us off once in a while. Anyway, he went into the service, and that was the best time. I was telling George, we were talking about this on the way up, but I was telling George that he went in the service, and he told them he wasn't married, and here he was married with three kids. So therefore, the check would go to him. And my mother was on welfare and working, and the lady came and said, "This is your last check." And she said, "Why?" And she said, "Because you're getting a check from the Army." And she said, "No, I'm not." And thank God they knew my mother was an honest woman, and they checked into it, and sure enough, he had done that. And so they turned it around and had it, so the check came to my mother, and boy, did we live. We got our school clothes, and once a month, not once a month, but every couple of months, we'd go to White Plains, New York. We'd take the bus in, and we'd go shopping, and we'd go out for Chinese food. I still love Chinese food. And it was a nice time. But of course, then he got out of the service, and we were back to having a tough time. But I still think, I still believe that I had a nice childhood. We had a lot of fun, my sister, my brother, and I. We didn't do a lot, but, you know, go to the movies, stuff like that. Anyway, then into high school, I went out for sports. I loved field hockey. We were talking about field hockey recently, too. And I just loved that, and I loved cheerleading, too. So I was active in those two things. I always managed to have good friends. I always managed to have nice guys that I dated, and but I didn't like to be tied down. I went steady twice, once for a half a day and once for an hour. I didn't want to get tied down. Too much living to do, I guess. And we did have a lot of fun. My friend and I quit our jobs when we were 19 and bought a car together and moved to Coral Gables, Florida. We were going to live down there. Well, we would get phone calls from home from the gang, and they would say, "We're having a party, we miss you, and and why aren't you home?" And we were so homesick, and we didn't want to admit it. So we ended up leaving. When we left, it was Thanksgiving, and Christmas Eve day, we went back home. We had fun in Florida, but we weren't ready to leave home yet. So, and our parents knew we were coming. They knew we were homesick, so we came home. So even though we thought we were big girls, we were still just little kids, actually. I guess we were homesick. But we were independent. I was a very independent. Before alcoholism, I was very independent. I thought I could do just about anything. I don't think I realized what alcoholism did to me until I was about 10, 15 years into marriages with alcoholism in it. I dated a fella, and then I was pinned to him, a nice guy. He was a vet. He was a few years older than I was, and I was about 20 then. And his name was Walter. And he was a diver. And one New Year's Eve, we were at the American Legion, for a party, and there was a gal there that was a diver too, and he had the audacity to talk to her. How dare he talk to her? That's the way I was. I was spoiled, just a real little brat. And I thought the whole world and everyone in it revolved around me. And my higher power, too, who I choose to call Jesus Christ. I believe that it revolved around me, the whole universe. Because if I wanted something, I'd say, God, give me this, give me that, give me that. And then if I got it, I would never say thank you. I would just, you know, it would just fade away. And so, as I say, I was very immature. Because of that immaturity, when I was out that night with Walter, and he talked to this nice young lady, I took my fraternity pin off and dropped it in his beer and walked out. And the next day I went and found my two friends, Eileen and Betty, who I'm still friends with today. And I said, come on, we're going to the Elbow Room for some action. So Elbow Room was a local hangout. And went to the Elbow Room, and of course I meet this guy who was sarcastic. He could really drink, and I wasn't used to a lot of drinking. We did a little bit in high school, but no big deal. But his name was Ed Schutte, and when he said he was going to call, a lot of times he wouldn't. When he'd make a date, a lot of times he wouldn't pick me up. And that, because of my immaturity, that fascinated me. So, but I think the drinking and the dancing and all that whole stuff fascinated me. And we ended up getting married. I worked at the Reader's Digest. I built myself up to a real good job there. And we started having babies. And I had Edward, and I went back to work. And then I had Thomas, and then went back to work. And I had Gregory, and I thought, gee, it's maybe time for a little girl. But I had Gregory, and then went back to work because they gave a bonus at the end of the year. If you came back, you know, you would get it. Anyway, then I had Michael. And Michael was born legally blind. He really should have been born before they said, I mean, before he was, because the doctor wasn't there, and I kept saying, this is my fourth child. I think I know. I think he wants to be born, or it wants to be born. And they said, no, you have to wait. The doctor's not here. And when he was born, he had all kinds of eye problems. And I do believe if it had waited much longer, he might have had cerebral palsy, because he was a little uncoordinated, too. I used to have to show him how to crawl and stuff. But he's fine. He's a brilliant guy, and he's out in California. He's doing very well. Anyway, then I stopped working. That was a lot of kids. I had 5 children in 6 years. And I think I had a nervous breakdown and didn't know it. But I have to say that was, as far as the children went, I love babies. I love grandbabies. I just loved being with them. But it was a tough time. It was a lot of work. So anyway, I get pregnant again. And I had a little dress, a little yellow dress, a smocking, and I put it in a box with a miraculous medal, and I would take it out and I'd pray to the Virgin Mary, Mary, if you give me a little girl, I'll name her Mary. And so I would keep praying and praying, and maybe once a month or so, or once every few weeks, I'd take the dress out and pray. And I always prayed that it would be healthy too. So I went into labor with the fifth baby, and same doctor delivered him, and the same anesthesiologist was there too, I guess, or I don't even think it was another gynecologist who happened to be there waiting for a patient. Because usually they would just, if they gave me anything, like with Michael, it was when they said, it's a breach. I said, it's a breach, and then they put me out. But usually they wouldn't give you that much if you wanted to have it naturally. So anyway, I'm on the delivery table, and all of a sudden, the baby's delivered, and Dr. Kish holds the baby up and says, look, baby, it's a girl. And I saw the umbilical cord and thought it was something else, and I said, that's not funny. So they said, hurry up, give her her glasses, because I'm blind as a bat. I have contacts in. I'm very blind. But anyway, the baby was born, and I proceeded to name her Kathleen. So that shows you how I was with my prayers and stuff. I'm just trying to show you the kind of person I was. And very immature, very into myself and stuff. And I believe it was my children that helped me to grow up. I really had to grow up with 5 kids. And then their father started to get physically abusive. And first he was I realized he was a, quote, swinger. He was a bartender, and he had the landscape gardening business during the day. And I knew that he was fooling around, as they say. And at one point, I tried to get back at him and nearly destroyed myself, and so I stopped that. I think that's when I started to grow up, when I realized you're only hurting yourself. So the more physically abusive he got, the more I realized that it was time for me to leave. But it was one morning when the oldest son came to me and said, Eddie said, Mommy, did Daddy have your head in a suitcase last night? I said, why? He said, we could hear you screaming, and then you would stop, and then you would scream, and then you would stop. And here he would put his hand over my mouth and then beat me some more. And so I thought, what am I doing to me, but what am I doing to these kids? What are they growing up with? I mean, I think a lot of women have a hard time leaving that situation because they keep thinking it's going to get better, it's going to stop. Well, I got to the point where it didn't matter what happened. I knew for the sake of my children that I had to get out of there. So we did get out. We went back once to see if it would work, and it didn't. He continued to be abusive. So I left, and I never regretted it. It's something I just never regretted. The children still saw their dad and their grandparents. And so anyway, here I am, single, sorta, with 5 kids. And I would work on, a lot of times I said I would never do this, I'd never do that. And every time I say I'd never do it, I do it. So I'm very careful today even about saying I never, never. Because it seems like God's up there saying, okay, time for a lesson. And then I would get another lesson. And so anyway, here we are, single, 5 kids and me. They would go on the weekend, so the logical job for me was waitressing when I wouldn't have to have a babysitter, and I did do that, and I met a lot of nice, hardworking people. I never thought I'd be a waitress, but I was, and I met good people. I met all kinds of people and made some money and to buy stuff for the kids and all. But I was working in a place in Ridgefield, Connecticut, because where I live borders Westchester County, New York, and Fairfield County, Connecticut border each other. And so you can just drive a little ways and you're into Connecticut. So I worked there in a place called the Alibi Inn. It was like a nightclub. And this guy used to come in, and he was sarcastic. You know what I'm going to say. And he really drank, but he was obnoxious when he drank. I mean, in Connecticut, you had to have all the liquor, all the glasses in behind the bar by 1 o'clock in the morning, or you could be shut down. And I used to have to go out, go in from behind the bar, because we'd be all working to get the glasses. And anyway, long story short, he wouldn't give up his glasses. And I said, "Why are you so obnoxious?" And he said, "It gets your attention, doesn't it?" And he was right, it did. Well, then he started coming in when he was sober. He'd be doing his laundry and he'd stop in. And I thought, gee, he's not such a bad guy. Well, you know what I did. I ended up marrying him because he needed us. He needed the five kids and me to straighten him out, to help him out. And I married the exact same type of person. And I told you, I love alcoholics. So anyway, I don't know what the attraction is, but there was an attraction. Anyway, we were transferred to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I had never, ever been away from home in my whole life, and I think that's when I had my bottom. I really do. Because I didn't have my girlfriends. I could call them, but it wasn't the same. I didn't have my friends that I grew up with. I grew up in the same area. My family wasn't there, and he was out. And he was like, you know how they say it's a crest and then it goes down? Well, he was about right up here. Everything he did was right. Everything at work he did, and whenever he'd do something, he'd get a promotion. That wasn't to last, though, but he was at that point when I was at my bottom. And so anyway, we were transferred again to Ohio. And Rue, his name was Rue Durden, and he picked Maumee, Ohio, to move us to. And it was a nice town to raise the kids. We lived there about, I think I lived there 19 years, and one of my children still lives there. By this time, I think I started to grow up a little bit. We were in Maumee, and his drinking went up over the top and started down. He was going fast down. He would take a glass of wine out of the refrigerator, and he would, I mean, you could see him absolutely get smashed right in front of you. He was so saturated with alcohol. And then things started going bad for him. He lost his job. I mean, it really was really getting bad. But anyway, one holiday weekend, it was at Easter time, we had a big fight, and I started down the river road, and I thought, I'm just going to drive this car into a pole and end it all. And again, my kids saved me. I thought, what will my kids do, go with their alcoholic father in New York or their stepfather, alcoholic stepfather? And I thought, no, there's something wrong. He drinks, but there's something wrong with me, too. I got to find out what's wrong with me and why I can't leave. And so the next day, I called AA because I didn't really know about Al-Anon. And the gal that worked in the AA office at that time was an Al-Anon lady, longtime Al-Anon lady. And she said, "Honey, from what you've told me, you need Al-Anon, and this is where the meeting is on Monday." And so I went. As a matter of fact, I just recently went to their 33rd anniversary, I think it was, in the Toledo area. And I went to that meeting, and I really liked it. I wasn't honest, because one girl asked me where I lived, and oh, I didn't want anyone to know he was an alcoholic, even though he fell down drunk coming home, and you know, the whole bit, was out in the bars to all hours, had crashing the company car and all that. So I said, "Well, I live down near the river." And then she said, "Oh, Maumee." I said, "No, Perrysburg, because one's on one side, one's on the other." So I wasn't honest at first. But like with most of us, there's something there. We're not sure what it is, but there's something there. And it took me years to really talk at a meeting. Every time I opened my mouth, I cried, So I would even pass when they would read the steps one at a time, one person at a time. I would pass because I just couldn't talk. I finally started talking at a conference in a round robin, and thank God I did, or I still might be sitting in that meeting and missing all the good stuff. Anyway, I kept going to Al-Anon. For a while it was kind of sporadic because if he stopped drinking, I didn't go for a week or so, you know, and then he would drink again and then I would go. And finally it dawned on me that the best way to do this, as they told me, was to keep going. Pick a meeting, keep going. And if you're new here in Al-Anon, don't do it the way I started to do it. It's just a waste of time. Find a meeting that you like or a couple of meetings you like and go to them. And let the people get to know you, and you'll get to know the people. It changed my life. Al-Anon made me grow up, helped me to grow up. It helped me to see that I was attracted to the to people because my picker wasn't working, and it still doesn't work. I think after many years of Al-Anon, you think you might pick, do the right picking, but you don't know. I don't know, and I would turn everything over to God, just like I did when I met George. So anyway, I'm jumping around a lot today. Let me just stop for a minute and give you this little quick little cute joke. Maybe it'll help me to relax a little bit. It's not really a joke. It's kind of nice. Like a pumpkin. A woman was asked by a coworker, "What's it like to be a Christian?" The coworker replied, "It is like being a pumpkin. God picks you from the patch, brings you in, and washes all the dirt off of you. Then he cuts off the top and scoops out all the yucky stuff. He removes the seeds of doubt, hate, greed, etc. And then he carves you a new smiling face and puts his light inside of you to shine for the world to see." And I really like that. I think that's a good definition of a Christian. I think that's one thing that did save me. I always had God in my life. And when you have God in your program, it really makes the program easier. Rue got sober. He said, "It's because I used to tell him, 'Someday, Rue, you're going to get sober.' Well, I remember saying it, but I know I didn't mean it because I never thought he would get sober. It was his family. It was his life. I mean, from the time he was a young boy, that was his family and his life, drinking and bars. And yet he did. In 1975, he got sober for the last time. He's still sober as far as I know. And the kids were growing up. Kathleen was in high school. We started a group in Perrysburg called Sharing and Caring. That was in 80, and we were having our first anniversary in 81. Kathleen had graduated high school in June, and this was October. We were sitting around after the meeting, as you do when you have an anniversary or something, and we cleaned up and we were talking, and we heard all these sirens, and we thought, "What's that? What's going on?" Well, we all went home, and I climbed into bed, and Rue was already there, and all of a sudden, I saw lights shine on the in our bedroom window, and I looked outside, and it was a police car. So I woke up Rue, and he went downstairs because we had a couple of our older boys were living on their own. So he came back up, and he said, "They won't tell me anything until you come downstairs." So I went downstairs, and they told us that Kathleen and three of her friends were killed in an automobile accident. They hit one lonely tree in a meadow. Another car was involved, but we don't know how much. They did collide at one point, but we don't know when. And 10 years later, that young man committed suicide. So there were 5 deaths actually from that accident. And I couldn't believe it. As soon as I got a chance, I ran upstairs into her bedroom because I was sure she'd be in bed. And I opened the door and she wasn't in her bed. And I remember feeling this heat come all over me. And I went back downstairs. And all the times we had this Rita from Toledo, who was my first sponsor, used to say, "You gotta be at the track to collect. You gotta be there to get the insurance. You gotta be at the meeting to get the insurance for when you need certain things. Someone's gonna say something, you know, that's gonna help you." And so that's when it kicked in, because there's a page in our One Day at a Time book that says about a minister going to the door and telling a woman that her husband had been killed. And she proceeded to invite him for a cup of tea. And he said, "How can you make a cup of tea when I'm telling you your husband died?" And she said, "My mother told me when I was a little girl, whenever anything dreadful happens, just continue doing what you would have been doing and you will be okay." And I remembered that page, and I did that, and I was okay with the help of Al-Anon and AA people. Every time I'd go to a meeting, somebody would come up to me and tell me about something that happened to one of their children. I never realized so many people had the same thing happen to them. 7 months later, Rue decided he no longer wanted to be married to me. He wanted to find himself, he said. But he forgot to tell me he was taking somebody with him. And they say when something traumatic like that happens in your life, you know, a death of a child, unless the marriage is very strong, a lot of times it will break up. And that's exactly what happened to 3 out of 4 of the families. Anyway, Rue left. I went for counseling, hoping it would be marriage counseling. And then my sponsor is the one that insisted that I go, thank God. And I found myself again. I had lost myself in the disease of alcoholism. And with Sid's help, the counselor's help, I found me again. I found out who I was, what I wanted. I became a free spirit, really. And I continued to live with Al-Anon. I never left Al-Anon. I continued to live and be happy. I was very happy. That's what I was like before Al-Anon. I told you a little bit of what Al-Anon has done for me, but this is just the beginning of it. The thing that really affected me the most was my service work. If anybody is involved in service work, you know what I mean. If you're not, please try it. It changes your life, it changes the program for you, it makes you more aware of what's going on around you instead of just into you, into yourself, and I'm forever grateful for that gentle push or shove into service. Scared to death, hated the state meetings because they were smoky. Well, they aren't anymore, and I smoked, they were smoky. I have a headache every time, and I think, how come they're arguing, and you know, and all this stuff. Well, it's a business meeting, and people have different opinions, and it's all according to who the people are. Sometimes it goes smoothly, sometimes it doesn't. But I have to say that I learned what I wanted to be like, and I learned what I didn't want to be like, and it really helped and saved me. I really, truly believe I would still be at the meetings crying and moaning and thinking about me unless I'd gotten involved in service. I was bebopping along. I had a decent job. The company was bought out by two companies, first one and then another, and I did end up having a job out of it, thank goodness, because I was self-supporting. And I bought out my husband, my ex-husband, so I had the house, and I had a car, and I'd go to Florida once a year or so, and my life was really good. I went to a lot of conferences. We went to the internationals, and it was really good. And I was coming off of a friendship that had really gone bad with a gal. I mean, she really turned on me, and I couldn't understand it. She was not in the program. And I was dating someone, and the same thing happened. And I thought, that's it. I'm through with men. I'm through with this. I'm through with everything. I'm just going to go to Al-Anon, go to conferences, and enjoy myself. And I would have, and I did. And I went to an Atwood conference, Al-Anon conference, and who is there but George O'Neill? And I went back to the room. I said, oh, George O'Neill's here, and he looks so cute. And the gal, one of the gals I was with said, why don't you start dating him instead of some of those jerks you've been dating? And she was absolutely right. But I said, I can't do that. That's Carol's husband, because I knew his wife, Carol. Carol had passed away, but that's George's story. Anyway, I decided that I wasn't going to do anything, even though I thought he was cute. Merp had led that time, and everybody's around him. I lost my watch. Is that a omen or something? Got it. I got it. Thank you. Anyway, that means I can talk and talk. No. I met George there, and Merp talked, and he needed help, and I asked him if he wanted some, and I helped him, and we went up for ice cream, and then he bought our dinner the next day because I helped him the next day too. And I thought, just stay out of it, stay out of it, stay out of it. Don't do a thing. And I didn't. And somehow we got together. I wrote him a thank you for buying our dinner and stuff. And he sent me back. He sent me a tape or whatever. And next thing I know, he's coming through on business. And we started dating. And I had told everyone I sponsored, I said, now look, you got to know someone. First I said two, and then I changed it to three. I said, you got to know someone at least 2 to 3 years, because if there's some kind of mental problem, it'll show up by then. Before you even think of marrying. And they said, okay. You know, I was strong-willed, I guess. Anyway, I met George, that was October. We started dating, I think it was November. We got engaged on Christmas. And we got married to a kazoo wedding on March 19th. And all the girls that I sponsored said, what happened to this 2 and 3 year bit? Who is this George O'Neill, you know? I said, well, wait till you meet him and you'll see why. And they did, and they loved him like I did. He was just such a super nice guy, and he was a sober alcoholic. I think he was sober 19 years then. Anyway, I started in the program, I don't think I told you, in 1971. And it was a lot of rough years for me. I was a slow learner, but I am so grateful. We have a great marriage. It's been a little rough since we retired because we're really together, if you know what I mean. But we get through it because we really like each other too. We love each other, but we like each other too. So if we have differences in opinion, or if I tell him how to do something and he tells me how to cut the bread or something, we just kind of try to overlook a lot of that. But, and then a lot of times we'll discuss it and then drop it. Once we talk about it, it's over. I mean, once we discuss it, it's over. We don't hold grudges because that can kill a marriage. I'm so grateful for what Al-Anon has done for me. I don't know, I can't see the clock. Okay, thanks. Okay, I don't know if I've gotten the point across about Al-Anon. I always pray to God that I give a good Al-Anon lead because my story is kind of sad in some ways. In other ways, it's a joyous celebration of me because I lived through, as my first sponsor would tell me, you've lived through so many things that she used to say, you can be an inspiration. I'd say, Rita. And she said, no, you can be an example for people who are going through something similar, either a divorce or abuse or death of a loved one. She said, you have a lot in your background to share, but it's not a happy thing, you know what I mean? But I am happy, if that's any help. I am very happy. I'm happy that this program came into my life, or I came into the program, whichever the case may be. If any of you out there have not tried Al-Anon, don't be afraid to go. Yes, it'll change you, but not in the way that I think you might be afraid of. You get out of this program exactly what you put into it. If you put in a little bit, you'll get a little bit. If you're looking for a man, you'll find a man. Really. But if you're looking for a new way of life and you want your life to change and you want to better yourself, that'll happen too. And that's what I aim for. I have one more joke, and then I'm going to shut up. There are two statues in a park, one of a nude man and one of a nude woman. They had been facing each other across a pathway for 100 years, when one day an angel comes down from the sky and with a single gesture brings the two to life. The angel tells them, as a reward for being so patient through 100 blazing summers and dismal winters, you have been given life for 30 minutes to do what you wish to do the most. He looks at her, she looks at him, and they go running behind the shrubbery. The angel waits patiently as the bushes rustle and giggling ensues. After 15 minutes, the two return, out of breath and laughing. The angel tells them, you have 15 minutes left. Would you care to do it again? He asks her, shall we? She eagerly replies, oh, yes, let's. But let's change positions. This time, I'll hold the pigeon down and you poop on its head. What were you thinking? I want to thank you so much for inviting me to speak. Thank you, Milton and the committee, for inviting us here. We love this place. We hope to come back next year. We really feel the warmth of the people here, and you can see it. When you're up here, you can see it in your faces. It's wonderful. No man can touch the stars until he's known the depths of despair and fought his way back. Thank you very much.